Wage for Public Gigs, or many other initiatives that do incredible work here in Portland to keep it such a vibrant music city. And I want it to be known that the expo is not just about talking about these issues and alluding to a solution, but it is the solution. We want to give musicians the opportunity to be an active part of the solution by signing them up at tables around the expo to work on specific policy initiatives. So I couldn't be more excited about it. And if your listeners want to RSVP for the Resiliency Expo, they can do so at bit.ly/PDXExpo. That's PDXEXPO. Super excited about this.
How can our listeners support your work, both musicians and allies, and how do we reach you?
Yeah, so if you make money as a musician, I think this is the most important. Know that the Musicians Union exists and that you're welcome here. We suffer from a severe lack of an advertising budget here at our local. So most people don't even know that they can be part of a union, even as a freelancer or somebody with inconsistent or part-time music work or doing six or seven different jobs as a musician. You are welcome in our union, is what I want people to know more than anything. But in addition to that, if you live in the Portland metro area, if you're a musician, please attend the expo on the 9th. We're excited about it. We really want to get these things off the ground. We're hoping to build power all together and to bring advocates from many different policy working groups to build that momentum for change starting right now. And the more freelancers join our union or just engage with us at this event or at others in the future, the more collective power we can wield for that positive change.
Great. So that wraps it up for this evening's show. We've been listening to Hunter Bwen, organizer with the American Federation of Musicians, Local 99. I'm Jamie Partridge with my co-host, Laura Wadlin. This is Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Prison Pipeline.
We all listen. We're in the fire theater. We all listen to this fabulous station in Portland, and it's called
KBOO. It's a Lorenzo Milam original. It's one of his. It's one of his spawn. And we'd like to say hello to all the people at KBOO, and then thanks for that coffee cake that volunteer made 2 days ago.
Yeah, I'm still coming down, man.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammick and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about exciting concerts and events coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to previously aired shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House on Friday mornings, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7 a.m. right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Welcome to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. While the Oregon legislature has, in recent years, provided funding for mental health and addiction treatment and services, Oregon remains nearly last in the nation to provide adequate care to those in need. In 2020, Oregonians passed Measure 110, which decriminalized certain drugs, which were then recriminalized by the legislature in 2024. One nonprofit organization that continued to provide mental health and addiction services while adapting to this uncertainty is the Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon. This community-based organization, run by peers who, while at the forefront of advocacy for services and funding, continue to use their lived experiences to change the lives of people suffering with mental illness and addiction. My guests from the Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon are Janie Gullickson, Executive Director, and John Karp Evans, Deputy Director. Welcome.
Thank you, Karen, for having us.
Thank you.
So, Janie, let's start with you. The Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon is an inclusive, peer-led organization. So explain what that means and what services and programs do you offer?
Sure. Thank you for that question. So as an inclusive, peer-run organization, we meet people right where they are, both figuratively and physically oftentimes. And we are not providing services based on certain requirements or referrals. We have many programs where if anyone wants help, we can be there to support them in what help looks like for them. Having that personal lived experience in a similar way helps us connect with folks very quickly. We are inclusive in that, you know, all walks of life can experience mental health and or addiction issues. Those challenges are no respecter of person. Doesn't matter how rich or poor you are, what ethnicity or culture you come from or background. And so that's the inclusive nature of our work and our staff. And we will soon be the peer company. So the Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon, or MHAAO, will soon be the peer company. Easier to say and really more descriptive of who we are right on our face, because we are not an association and we provide peer services, which are non-clinical and supportive in nature for folks who have mental health and or addiction challenges and all the intersecting life experiences that can also be part of someone's life who has mental health and addiction stuff.
So, Janie, there's been a lot of changes in these past few years with Measure 110, with the decriminalization of drugs, to the recriminalization of drugs, to the creation of deflection. So can you talk about how your organization is adapting to or living with this uncertain landscape? How are you working with the counties, the state, and all of these changes?
I can confidently say that our services haven't really changed when it comes to the peer support we are providing for folks. It is still based on that shared lived experience, walking shoulder to shoulder with someone and getting to know what it is they want to achieve, the direction they want to go in, and how we can help them achieve those goals. With the transition from decriminalization of small amounts of drugs under Measure 110, and then the misdemeanor charge that can happen with small amounts of drugs that goes along with 4002, for the people we're serving, that didn't really matter. and they may not have been aware of that.
John Karp Evans, you're the Deputy Director with Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon. So can you talk about how you are working with deflection created by the Oregon Legislature in 2024? Are you doing outreach? Are you working with law enforcement? How is MHAAO working with deflection?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Karen. And just to set the stage a little bit, you know, peer work existed during criminalization, peer work existed through 110 through decriminalization, and now peer work is still existing through 4002, the recriminalization. And so for our work, and like Janie mentioned, our work has never changed. Sometimes the back end process changes, sometimes what kind of paperwork we do or who we connect with, those kind of things change. But as far as meeting someone in their most vulnerable state that's seeking services in a peer lens, we can do that and have been doing that through all these different legislative changes. And so for us, the work is still going on. The work's very similar. There may be some procedural stuff that changes, but at the end of the day, peer work is peer work is peer work. And we're there to help an individual in our community that's seeking services. As far as formal deflection goes, and I think that's another part of this conversation, you know, peers have been deflecting people since before formal deflection was a thing, right? We meet people where they're at. We support them through a person-centered plan and help them get connected to the care they're seeking, right, through sharing our lived experience. And so as far as the formal deflection process goes, we were doing formal deflection before. Now it's, what does the back end look like? You know, are they have to go through a deflection center, or do they just enroll in the deflection program? And because every county has a different formal deflection process, we found ways to insert that peer lens in the work we're already doing and connect it with the formal deflection process that exists in several different counties.
Talk about the process. What does it actually look like? Go through the steps.
What we do as peers, we may or may not connect to a formal deflection process, right? So we have people that are doing outreach 7 days a week, 361 days a year. And those folks are meeting people that may be houseless, that may not be houseless, that are seeking help with detox, help with sobering, help with shelter, help with substance abuse treatment, help with mental health treatment, help with primary care. And so we're really meeting people, having them guide what their recovery looks like, and then using our lived experience from a peer lens to help support those connections happening or not happening. And I think the real challenge that we see in our community is the lack of treatment services and lack of all services. And you mentioned that in the opening, you know, the peer lens is so vital, where an individual may not be able to walk into a treatment center that day. They may not be able to walk into a detox center that day. But if we can form a relationship as a peer support specialist and start to, maybe we'll meet you tomorrow, maybe we'll meet you the next day, maybe we'll meet you the next day, and keep that person engaged in support, because the process is a squiggly line, right? In my mind, the process of walking to treatment is a straight line to the door. In our community, it's this squiggly, it's a scenic route, right? And so as this person's maybe going around and around and around to get through that path, the peer can be there and share their lived experience. This is how I made a difference in my life. This is what helped. This is what didn't help. And the person can listen or not listen, because it's a voluntary process, but we can help support people if the path is a little longer than maybe it should be, or it should take, you know, because it takes a long time to get connected to care.
So, John, talk about the reasons why people won't seek help, the reasons why people rather live on the streets and not seek help.
Yeah, and I can speak about my personal challenge with substance abuse and how I was given multiple opportunities and didn't take advantage of them, right? And so I'm not saying I wanted to be in that life, but I was in the grips of my addiction. And when I was handed opportunities, literally handed opportunities, I chose not to take advantage of in my personal life, right? And so what I can leverage from that in the work that we do is that a person may accept help the first time or the 100th time. If we don't offer it that 100th time, can we say this person doesn't want help, right? Because I wanted help, I was offered help, and it took several attempts for me to engage in that care. And it's, if it was a one-shot deal, man, we'd have a cure for substance use and mental health, right? And to my knowledge, that doesn't exist. And so what we do from this peer lens is keep supporting, because we know recovery is possible. You're staring at a bunch of people. There's tons of people in our community that are in recovery. We all took different roads to get there, but the one thing we needed was support.
The magic of peer support is that almost immediately, someone, if they can't physically see, like, oh, hey, this person looks like me, looks like they have some experience, you know, like I do. We don't dress super professionally in a way that we would if we were going into the office or maybe some other more professionalized setting, especially in outreach or in those places where we're meeting folks potentially on the worst day of their life. And then we share just enough to see maybe their head raise, their eyes look at us and spark some hope, because change is not possible without the hope that change is possible. And then if I have hope, I may not know how to start changing. And so just to have someone take the time, listen, build that relationship, learn a little bit about me, and take some of those strengths that I'm obviously displaying by surviving on the streets or whatever situation I'm coming from, and highlight those strengths and let them know that they're not alone, and I'm gonna walk beside them in finding care and connecting to those resources that they may want or have been turned away from before. It's a scary landscape, and especially if you've walked in of your own volition early on, in your mental health or addiction challenges and have been turned away, you're not really going to trust that system much anymore. And so you're going to want that support in trying to connect to care. Addiction is addiction for a reason. It's hard to make changes. And John's used the analogy of how many times have we said, oh, we're going to start working out or eat differently, cut down sugar. How easy is that? Now imagine being physically addicted or in a state of crisis and survival day after day after day. That's not something easily fixed in one moment or one day, one week, or even a year. So recovery is a long game, and that's where peer support can be there from day one and potentially still be there 5 years later, right? When all other system supports or formal treatment programs have ended.
So John, you've been talking about peers and the work of your organization, but talk a little bit more about why peers are so important to this type of work. And talk about what it means to be a peer, their credentials, and talk about some of the barriers and challenges you face in your work as a peer.
I think, you know, one of the very basic, but sometimes maybe not talked about as much things about peer support is it's a voluntary service. And so when we look at services around the continuum, there can be mandatory, right? There can be things that you're required to do. There can be requirements that you have to fulfill to engage in different services where peer support is 100% voluntary. And so if I'm your peer support specialist and you say, hey, I don't want to do that. Today's not a good day, or this isn't what my recovery wants to look like, or I'm changing my mind. I'm there as a peer support to support that person through their journey, not to dictate this is what your recovery plan should look like, or this is the service you need to engage with, or this is where you need to go. It's really to help that person through their plan of recovery. And so that's where, you know, peer support is so valuable through this process where I've done a lot of things in my life. Very few of them look the same from the time I started to the time I ended. And, you know, peer support allows that person the freedom to change the process, change what their recovery looks like if we're talking about recovery, and then still have support through that process. So I'm not going to kick someone out or not work with them or provide peer support because they changed, you know, what their process should look like. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that, in my opinion, it's so valuable to helping people accomplish recovery from substance abuse, from mental health. You know, as far as becoming a peer, there's a certification. So there's a peer wellness specialist certification, certified recovery mentor certification. And at MHAL, Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon, we provide training. We have a training department that offers a training for individuals to come and receive that education that if you complete, it allows you to apply for those certifications through OHA or through MACBO.
So can you explain the barriers and challenges as a peer?
What I will say is that, you know, when I started doing peer work, a certification was not a big thing. It was not popular. It was around. And over the last 10 plus years, it's become a mainstream thing where we really can require folks to have a certification. And what it's done is really raised the playing field of the peer support specialist, and really, in my opinion, brought it up to the table equal with our clinical partners that we work with a lot of times. I'm not just someone that has lived experience. I'm someone that's trained. I have a certification. I get supervision. I'm held to ethical standards. And so really what we've seen with the certification is really raised the bar as far as, I mean, I thought I was doing great peer work before it, but it's brought the whole peer workforce up to that level where really now it always has been, but it seems more recognized as, hey, this person has a certification. This person has requirements. They have to get continuing education. They have ethical standards. They have all these different requirements that pre-certification weren't required in the field. And so it's really brought the level of a peer support specialist up to a new level. With that, I will also say that peer work is still peer work. Right. And so it's really important to stay in that voluntary, person-centered, not required process while it integrates with clinical care, integrates with the criminal justice system, integrates with all these different continuums that we have in our community, but it's still important to stay true to peer work. And I think, you know, I can give an example because I've been on a clinical side. where we had peers that were part of a team. And sometimes that peer support specialist had a better relationship with the peer than we did from the judicial side or from the clinical side. And it's really easy to say, hey, John, is that person using? Has that person returned to use? Has that person relapsed? What's going on? And that's not a peer's role, right? But we've seen peer support be so impactful and get so connected to the people we're serving our community that it was easy for me from the other side to try to leverage them out of scope to provide more information because I saw how effective they were at getting engaged and getting involved in that person's life. And so when we flip back to the peer support role, it's really important as we continue to grow and as we continue to train and support and supervise our staff, is that how do we provide these service and connect to these other systems, but also have that voluntary person-centered plan as the true mission to our work.
And John, you mentioned law enforcement, and in some counties, deflection happens through contact with law enforcement. And I know when Measure 110 rolled out, law enforcement wasn't on board, whether it was lack of education or not given enough time to learn the process. How is that working now with law enforcement? Is it more of a partnership? Explain the process with law enforcement.
Yeah, I would say that we've had the luxury of Janie and Tara Hurst had a meeting with our NRT neighborhood response team, Portland Police Central, Downtown Bike Patrol is what they are, and during 110, and we have formed MHAO along with lots of community partners. I wouldn't even say just us. Lots of community partners in the Portland metro area have formed an amazing relationship with our downtown police, our central precinct officers. And so pre-deflection or pre-formal deflection, we had an amazing opportunity to start working with our officers in the downtown core specifically. And we have a police provider joint connection program. It's a funded program where we communicate daily with law enforcement, and law enforcement does their work and we do our work. And so we've never infringed on stopping law enforcement or saying you should or shouldn't do this, because I don't know, I'm not a law enforcement officer. But I do know when someone engages with law enforcement and wants help, it's within our scope to meet that person and to offer peer services if that's what they're interested. And so in the police provider joint connection program during Measure 110, police would ask folks if they were interested in peer services. If they would, they would call us. We can go respond on the street corner and engage with the folks. And through 4002, we've seen a little shift to that, but we're still operating the same program and we're still engaging the same way. And so we work with our police daily. We have staff that talk to officers every single day. And it's also brought a lot of community partners in. So we have joint outreach days where we work with law enforcement. We work with Portland Fire with our chat team. We work with our city and our county outreach workers. We work with other nonprofits where we all collaborate around a table and really figure out, regardless of entry point, what is the best way to get someone into the continuum of care in our community? And that may be a culturally specific provider. That may be through law enforcement. That may be through an MHAO peer. That may be through our day center. And so we've really brought the continuum together and really found out a way to, how do we get someone the right access to the service they're seeking? It may be us, it may not be us. It may be law enforcement, it may not be. But if we're not around the same table, we have a hard time saying, well, I don't know what they're doing, I don't know what they're doing. And when we're together, we can really communicate on the same page.
And Janie, this is tough work. This is very difficult work. Can you talk about how you help peers stay connected, make sure their well-being is in check? And I understand that one of the things that Mental Health and Addiction Association of Oregon started was Peerpocalypse. Talk about all that.
I would love to. And Karen, you nailed it when you said this is hard work. And I'd like to say that we are the people we serve. We're just at a little different place in our lives. Right. And so we are still navigating our own recovery journeys, our wellness journeys, discovering who we are as people, maybe just putting our lives together, finding out what our interests are, both in our professional lives and personal lives. And we are one of the very few, if not only, profession that wears their lived experience in the title of their role. So every space we walk into, people know we have those lived experiences. And so that is part of the challenges also, because are we looked at as a forever client if we're in a rural community working in a location where our probation officer used to be, or the judge that incarcerated us, or our therapist was? How do we overcome that hurdle and or the suspicion of, if we're having a challenging day or we're experiencing burnout, can we be accused of returning to use or relapsing or not being able to work that day in a way that people who don't show up with their lived experience front and center, but certainly probably have it because humans are human and have human experiences, right? So those are some of the other factors that can contribute to the compassion fatigue or burnout. And then how to combat that is through great supervision. Supervisors who have been there, been in that professional role, aren't trying to provide therapy to us, but invite us to talk about some of those things in a way that is person-directed also. Like, what helps you move through that? And can I connect you to what's available in our HR, people and culture department, our employee assistance programs? We have wellness days where someone can say, I'm not sick and I'm not on vacation, but I just need a day or a few hours to support folks in just taking some time. And then, of course, health benefits and comprehensive dental and EAP and physical health plans through supervision, also bringing things and keeping things in scope of peer work. Because when we are excited and passionate about this work, and we want to say yes to things that may be outside of scope, and as that scope creep or peer drift, as it's also known, happens, we can become exhausted because the need is so great and we want to fill those gaps. And it may sound cruel to say, well, we're not the answer to everything. And sometimes you have to walk away at the end of the day and turn your phone off and not be available for a phone call that might come at 2 a.m. But that's your day job. And what you can help support someone in finding is, who are they going to call at 2 a.m. if they need to? We can't be everything to all people. So, Peerpocalypse, I'll start by saying how it impacted my life, changed my life in ways I did not know were possible. I was a peer support specialist in Yamhill County in my third year of doing that work and felt a bit isolated in that work. And this little save the date card came across my desk, Peerpocalypse in 2013. And I was so intrigued. And to learn that there were others doing this work, that it was a movement of more than just people in the profession, that there were those who had come before, that there were people who advocated for this to even become a profession. I was so excited to attend, and I was given support to attend. And there were 89 people at Oregon Gardens. And what I learned in those 3 days changed my life. And I wanted more of that. I needed to know more and be part of this larger network of folks. So I sort of stalked the people that worked at MHAO, all three of them, and said, what can I do to be a part of this? And there was so much more those three people were doing that I learned about that I was just blown away. They hired me part-time to help plan the second Peerpocalypse. And that's how I got started at MHAO in 2014. And it's a conference by us for us. There certainly have been other professional conferences that we can be a part of, but this really allowed for networking, for peer support specialists in the workforce, for folks, let's say, who are living at the Oregon State Hospital to come and see folks who actually were at a different place in their lives and maybe be inspired by what they were learning and what they were experiencing by attending Peerpocalypse. So it wasn't just a professional peer conference. It really is a leadership conference of those with these lived experiences, whether working in the profession or not. And yes, we can get CEUs or continuing education credits for every workshop and keynote that we hear. Our cup gets filled by having others who can relate to how hard this work is or how wonderful this work is. And then just building community outside of even the workshops by being in Seaside and having a bonfire on the beach and being able to relax and breathe and come together in that way. So there are so many wonderful aspects of the conference that it has grown from that 89 people in 2013 to this year in 2025, we had 1,000 in-person attendees and many hundred more virtually participate. So it's a good time and a professional development conference all wrapped up in one.
John, can you talk about what is still needed for you to do your work?
I think, there's certain areas where it's like, oh, it makes perfect sense. We need a peer in this situation. And then there's other areas where it might be a second thought. And we've started to see maybe, a corporate setting or a setting that might not be, strictly around a houseless community where folks are like, oh, peer support's valuable in these areas. And so we see expansion of, hey, it's not just for this population or this setting, but how can peer support be valuable in a retail setting, in educational setting. And so as we start to look at, how does peer support grow or continue to thrive, I see it, what does it look like in settings that may or may not be mainstream where peer support's right now? And then the other thing Janie mentioned is really about supervision, about continuing education, about, I'm just not someone that has...